Hello, I'm Gary Pittard, and thank you for joining me for this special podcast, a case study on how to open your own profitable real estate agency. In this program, we feature an interview with agency leader Peter Tran, principal of Johnson Real Estate in the Queensland suburb of Forest Lake. Opening a real estate agency can be challenging enough if you do it the right way, but there are many pitfalls for the unwary, and if you fall victim to these, they can cost you lost profit. Even worse, many of these pitfalls are not easily reversed. One example is debt. Once you're in, it can be hard to get out. Too many business owners get into too much debt too soon, particularly by leasing equipment that the business can't afford. Too much debt has been the doom of many startup agencies, but it's not the only trap into which you can fall. The purpose of this podcast is to give you a real-world case study of an agency that started from scratch and today is a profitable business, not without its challenges, but it is growing and thriving. Peter Tran will share with you how he started his agency and how he steadily grew it, rather than trying to start too big at the beginning. I think you'll find it enlightening. This case study can be listened to as a standalone program, but I also recommend that you listen to other programs in the management section of the Pittard website. One important program is entitled How to Open Your Own Profitable Real Estate Agency. It's a series of audio files and a comprehensive full-color manual. You can download these files at no charge, and they will give you a full step-by-step guide to opening an agency the right way. Peter Tran will answer many questions for you about how to open a profitable real estate agency, but no doubt the points he raises will lead you to having other questions. So listen to the case study and study the comprehensive course, How to Open Your Own Profitable Real Estate Agency. These tools will help you get off to a flying and to a profitable start. Let's cross now to Peter Tran. Look, thanks for joining me, Peter. Let's begin by talking about your experience in real estate prior to opening your agency. What was your first position in real estate?
I started as a rookie in an office that ran the Pittard program back in 2006 in March. I was a home finder for about 3 months, and then I went into sales.
So for those listening, a home finder is a full-time prospector?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, and so you did that for 3 months?
Yes.
And then after that?
And then went straight into sales, and I remember the first quarter was about finding my feet. In the next 12 months, I achieved a gold badge doing 100 sides.
Okay, so that's virtually the equivalent of 50 full sales.
That's correct. Yeah.
And a gold badge, you're producing in excess of $400,000 per annum.
That's correct, in gross, yes.
Yeah, and that was in your first year.
That's correct, yes.
So that's great. Now, do you think that those skills stood you in good stead when you opened your agency?
Yeah, definitely, Gaz, because going through it as a salesperson, I think it's really important, because now that you've got salespeople coming through, not only do you understand the processes of what needs to be done to get to a winning level, but you also get to understand like the emotional intricacies that they also go through as well.
Yeah, you certainly understand it from, well, you're in the shoes of a salesperson. You can put yourself in their shoes when they're having difficulties.
Absolutely, yes.
But what about your ability to get stock? Do you think it's essential that when you open an agency that you know how to list and sell?
Yeah, mate, I remember starting here in Forest Lake in 2011. The first thing I went back to was the basics. So I considered myself as a salesperson. The first thing I opened up was the Winning Ways manual. And I made sure that I got my head right. I was doing 10 pages a day. I was doing my affirmations. And I just got out there and I just door knocked pretty much from morning till night.
Yeah, so you knew what to do. You'd been through it yourself. But when it comes to paying the bills, you need stock. So as a principal, do you think it's important that you know how to get the listings?
Absolutely. And that was our pure focus. It was all about stock when we first started. So it was not only did I start door knocking, I was doing STLs as well. So we're printing that. Me and my wife were folding it, signing it, stuffing it, and were actually delivering it before I went out door knocking as well. So it was pretty full on.
So you did this prior to opening? You started marketing the agency in the area where you plan to open?
No, straight up, Gaz. So We said, look, let's get out there in Forest Lake is where we started.
Yeah.
Started door knocking, then started collating the database, started printing STLs, So we sort of just jumped in the deep end, so to speak.
Yeah. So, you know, this is where these prospecting skills and these selling skills really are an absolute asset, because you just get out, you start marketing your business.
Absolutely.
Mm. How much money did you set aside for setup and for fit out in your first 3 months trading?
The initial investment, so we put in $15,000 of our own money, and the Johnson Real Estate Group put in 15, so a total of 30.
Total of 30. And this is, these are your partners in the Johnson Real Estate Group. So you're a top salesperson in the Johnson, in the Johnson Group, and then they partnered you into your own agency.
Absolutely. Yes.
Hmm. And so all up $30,000. Now, did that include setup, fit out, and trading money?
Yeah, we also took a salary, so we decided to pay ourselves a salary from day dot.
Mm-hmm.
But we started off, we signed a 1 year lease, and I think that's important for, like, as a new business starting, is to keep your overheads as low as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
I think the lease was about $14,000 a year. It was a little office suite sort of hidden away on top of a building. We bought a $50 phone, a $100 fax machine. I remember Trimmy bringing in his, you know, them old white picnic tables to set up as a desk.
Yeah.
So we started really much, very much from the ground upwards.
So a little hole in the wall, really.
In essence, yes.
Yeah. But you see, the beauty of that is these days nobody really comes into a real estate office, do they? It's not that you're entertaining buyers and sellers coming into the agency as used to happen in the 90s and even early part of this century, but these days now you're not having clients calling into the office, are you?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So you started out really small, really lean, and what was the advantage of that?
Cash flow. It was all cash flow. So we didn't have the overheads, because I remember Chris opening up in Bayside, there was a fair bit of overheads that were invested into that office. And it's almost like taking a big hole out of the cash flow and you have to rebuild back up to it. But because we invested such little money to start off with, we could slowly sort of build on top of that. And as the months went by, the money slowly accumulated. So we actually paid off that debt relatively quickly. And you were able to sort of build momentum from that, and it just kept on going.
Yeah, because what you did was you kept your break-even point very, very low.
Absolutely, and that became our major focus, was very much, I remember the first 6 months was all about survival.
Yeah.
So it was just prospecting, stock, selling it, and it became a matter of, you know, when are they settling as well. So it was all about survival in the first 6 months. And then I think 6 months onwards, that's when we started hiring support staff, hiring for other salespeople as well, and starting to create or build a team around that initial foundation.
So you start out small. You keep the expenses very, very low. You keep your operating costs. So all of your operating costs are kept very, very low. You sell, you list, you sell, you bring in stock, you make sales, and it takes a little time for those to settle. But as the money starts to come in the door, you pay back your initial $30,000 seed money, and you're still covering a very modest salary for yourself in the meantime.
Absolutely, yes.
And so then you get established, and then you start to grow from that point.
Yeah, and then it's a matter of looking for where's my next salesperson coming from.
Mm.
So we started hiring using the agency profit system.
Yeah.
Or the Ream system at the time. And I remember it was a real sticking point for me, because we hired a couple of salespeople. I remember a young lady, Amanda, that started with us. And we were very lean in the early stages, and I let her go relatively quickly. But I remember talking to Trimmy about it, and our cash flow was really, really tight, that at the end of the month we were struggling to be able to pay her out once she left, because we let her go.
Mm.
And it was a real turning point for me, because I remember sitting there thinking, well, okay, I'll pay her out of my own money, I'll get that sorted. But I said to myself, I will never, ever want to be put in this position ever again of having a salesperson and not having money at the end of the month to be able to pay them for whatever reason. And my mindset really shifted into, okay, we've got started, this is the foundations, how do we start building a big reserve? And my pure focus became on building that reserve account up to about 2 to 3 months running costs.
Yeah, you see, and this is smart thinking, because you see, it's very easy for somebody starting off a new business just to go in and lease expensive premises, go and buy expensive furniture, and every single time they do this, they add to their setup costs, and then of course they've got higher monthly costs, and they have to make more and more sales just to break even. They've got to make more sales before they ever start to make a profit, and this kills a lot of businesses. And as you say, you know, even with just one person who didn't work out, paying that person out was put the company into a very tight financial situation.
Very much so.
But if you'd have had a lot higher expenses, it could have sent the company broke.
Yeah, it'd be crippling, and I think it also would have. I could imagine the amount of pressure that would be on you, and your focus would shift away from, as opposed to listing and selling and prospecting, it shifts away from, okay, how am I going to pay my bills at the end of the month?
Yeah.
But also, I think I'm pretty lucky, guys, because I did have the support of, like, Chris and Jeff, Adam and Trimmy. So, like, having the other officers there sort of cushioned that as well, because sometimes you sort of shuffle money from other companies to make sure that you, once you've built that momentum, you're sort of, then you can start sort of paying your own way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's but you see, with your low expenses, you've given the business the opportunity to breathe, and
Absolutely. Maybe
30,000 all up as some start out capital might have been a little bit too low. So having the other officers there that can feed your cash flow for a little while, that certainly is helpful. But in hindsight, or looking back, did you lose money? Were there any months where you lost money?
Mate, there were some months where we probably would have been, because I remember Chris from his reserve helped us stay afloat, so to speak.
Yeah.
Especially in the very early stages. But we did get to a point where the debt was paid off, and then we started accumulating a reserve, and I was very much that. My goal in my head was to build that reserve up to 100,000, because if you've got 100,000 in your reserve, then not a lot can go wrong. Or if you have a bad month, it doesn't cripple you because you've still got another couple of months running costs.
For sure.
And that became the major driver, I suppose the major dominant goal in essence, over the next sort of, in the first couple of years from the business.
Yeah, build up a cash reserve, get yourself
Absolutely.
Feeling financially secure. Some people even think that's not a good idea, because they think, well, you know, having cash lying around, you should be investing it, and you should do other things with it. But when you think about it, business really is personal. And if you have the feeling of having a cash reserve, you sleep better at night, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's, as per the manual, it's like the mind to keep account. So knowing that there's 100,000 in there, I suppose it could be a detractor because you can get comfortable, but I certainly operate better when there's money in the bank than not in the bank.
Now, you mentioned going to the agency profit system. So you trained yourself. You were conscious then, were you, that moving out of a sales role, you certainly had skills as a salesperson, but now you would be going to become a business person. You're going to become an agency leader and an agency manager. So is that why you went to the agency profit system, to train you up in your new roles of leadership and manager?
Yeah, Gaz, I was pretty lucky because going back to when I got my gold badge, I ended up buying into that original business as a partner, like a three-way partnership. And when I bought into that business would have been, I think, 2008, I started going to the real estate management program then. So I've actually been to about two or three prior to actually opening up in 2011 with the Johnson Group.
Do you think that helped you?
Oh, massively, mate. Massively. And that gave me confidence to be able to step out on, or not on my own, like opening up a business ventureship, because I knew that I can lean back on them systems.
Yeah.
Not only the management system, but also the winning ways. Because initially when you're on your own, you've got to think you're a salesperson, so you've got to make sure that you're following that manual correctly. But at the same time, having the ability to change hats and following the other manual at the same time, so they sort of both combined.
Well, you see, on the management side, you were mindful of keeping your break-even low, which meant you needed to make fewer sales in order to make a profit. And
that's
I tell you what, some of the businesses that I've visited over the years, they're in all sorts of trouble because their debt levels are so high. You know, they have to make 4 sales a month just to cover their interest bills, let alone try and reduce their debt. So those are the hardest businesses to help that I've found. But by keeping your debt low and by training yourself in your new roles, you are better able to, well, you're aware of what mistakes not to make.
Absolutely.
What management tools, Pete, did you use to keep an eye on your agency expenses and the agency results performance? What were the tools that stood out?
Mate, the control board was the biggest, and the red book. So the control board is just like the cockpit. You can look up, see where you're travelling. You can look at the red book, see when your settlements are coming in as well.
Yes.
And I also had Trimmy behind the scenes monitoring the money pretty closely as well. So I was just really fortunate that I had that support network around me.
So it's important that you keep an eye on those expenses.
100%. Mm-hmm. Daily.
Now let's talk about culture, because one of the 7 essential elements for creating a profitable agency is the right culture. Did you make any conscious culture decisions when you first started your agency?
100%. I remember, I think in the management program talks a lot about culture, and that was a big thing for me. I wanted an office where it wasn't completely clear in my head what it would look like, but I knew I had certain standards and aspects that I suppose I wouldn't compromise on from salespeople, and I wanted to sort of build around that. So I was very conscious that I'd read the manual, make sure I did what the manual said, and stuck as close as I could to that.
Yes, yeah, and you set standards right from the beginning?
Yes.
What were the non-negotiables that you, when you say you set your culture around what you would and wouldn't accept from salespeople, what were some of the culture non-negotiables that you put into the business?
Being on time.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a saying in the office, if you're on time, you're late. So that was probably one of the first ones. Secondly would be numbers. So you've got to do your numbers.
Yeah.
And how we build our success is through the basics. So that's prospecting, being on time, respecting each other, honesty, replacing stock. So very much a lot of the culture ideas I got was very much from the Winning Ways manual and the management program as well.
Now, when you say replacing stock, if you sell a property, then you have to get a listing to replace it.
Very much so. So we've got a saying in the office as well, the listers rule the world.
Yeah, yeah. But isn't that true? You get so many people, oh, isn't it wonderful, Susan made 5 sales. Well, how many of those sales were Susan's listings? You know, why aren't we patting the listers on the back? And that's a big point, I think.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned that your early goal was to build up a cash reserve of $100,000. At the time you opened, did you have any other goals?
Probably 2. I always had a clear vision in my head that I wanted to build a championship team.
Mm-hmm.
What that looked like from my perspective was 6 solid salespeople. And I tried to model myself around teams like your Michael Meekins that have teams in place, but they've also got longevity in place as well. I think success is certainly measured on longevity, like the Doncaster boys or Todd Pierce's team that are following the program to a T.
Yeah.
They seem to have big teams, but also people that have been there for 10, 15 years as well.
Yeah, so they've got longevity with their team. They've got a quality of team. The team members are making good income, and the agency owners are making a great profit, and that's why they get the longevity from their team members. Everybody's happy.
Absolutely, and that's still is today one of my major focuses, major dominant goals. Also, I've always had a goal in my head on why I'm sort of doing it is financial freedom. I want to get there by 2026. So that were probably the 3 things that have stuck with me from the day I started, and that's still very clear in my head and what direction I want to head and where I want to take the team as almost like a vehicle to get me to that point,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And Pete, did you have, when you opened, a plan? And do you have a plan today?
It's an interesting question, because I remember first starting up, we'd sit there, we'd have the annual planning meetings, and we'd set specific, like, sales targets, listings targets. You know, we want a team of 4, listing 6 each, and we're going to make how many sales within that 12-month period. What I found doing that, though, is that you have a bad couple of months, and it's like that quote from Mike Tyson, is everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the face.
Hmm.
I found it wasn't quite productive with what we were looking at doing. What I found has been really helpful for myself is you have a certain direction on where you want to take the business, but you do that through process and culture. So what I find I've got control over is what processes are we doing within the office? what processes can I enforce on the team to make sure that they're following the system, and how strong is the culture? And I think having that in place, I've got control over that, which in turn leads me towards, or the team, towards that direction and where we want to head.
Did you have profit goals?
Initially, yes, but at the moment, not so much. It's more so about team size.
Yes, team size, and I'd be guessing to team quality. Because
absolutely,
you can build a big team if you're quite happy to keep mediocre people.
Yeah, we don't suffer fools here in Forest Lake. I think a good lesson I learnt very early on is there was the old adage of hire slow, fire fast, but now it's very much hire fast, fire fast. One thing I've had to teach myself to do is if they didn't fit the culture and they weren't getting results, I very much got rid of people very quickly.
Yeah, and
that's important.
And that's where we say in the agency profit system, hire for attitude, skill, and practical fit. And even if somebody's got the skill, if they haven't got the attitude and they haven't got the practical, they're not a practical fit for the team, they can destroy the team.
Absolutely.
Mm. So let's talk now about location. Do you believe that some locations are better than others? And what made you to decide on Forest Lake?
I think some locations are better. I think the market conditions are probably more important than location, I think, because certainly having offices all across southeast sort of Queensland, you can see certain offices tracking differently based on the market conditions.
Yes, so I remember Adam, so when he opened in Ipswich, remember they had, property prices were very, very cheap, but it was still very difficult to find buyers at one stage.
Absolutely, yes. So I think it's more so the market conditions than location. Because I still believe that if you open up in any location with the structures and systems of what I've seen, if you work the system, then you'll get results. It's because I've, as a salesperson starting over there in the Jindalee area, it worked then, and going over at Birkdale on the other side of Brisbane, it worked then, and going back starting in Forest Lake, you still get results. So I think it's more so following the system is probably the most important.
But what were the market conditions that made Forest Lake so attractive at the time?
I grew up in the area, and also there was, out of all the suburbs surrounding here, Forest Lake had the highest turnover. So I saw in the boom time there was about 900 properties sold in Forest Lake alone in a 12-month period.
Right.
So that I followed the money. I followed the money, that's
well,
where.
They're good reasons. I mean, if you are getting turnover in an area, then you know there's business to be had. Some people open up in areas that they like the area, but you might have 1,500 properties and 4 real estate agents. I mean, it makes life a bit tougher right at the beginning, doesn't it?
Yes.
Now let's talk about name. Now I know that you were already part of a group that are independent real estate agents, but no doubt over the time you've all been together as a leadership group, you've had a discussion of whether to be independent, whether to be a marketing group, or whether to be in a franchise. Do you want to just talk our listeners through the benefits of independent and why you stayed independent and resisted marketing groups or franchises?
Gary, I've been pretty lucky because I've never had exposure to like a franchise group at all. So only being exposed to like independent names, I think I've been sheltered in that regard. So I don't know how it's like on the other side, so to speak. I suppose having the overheads, you don't have to pay like the commissions and everything. That's probably a starter. And you get to build your own brand. I suppose it gives you control too.
Well, you've got control of the name, and certainly I know that that Andrew Trim has certainly talked to him a lot about that. You've got control of the name, you own it. But the big thing was paying 8% of your gross of your gross income on each sale to a franchise, especially marketing groups are cheaper. But you also that can be 40, 50, 60, 70% of the profit. And we have over the years seen many, many, many times where the business owner makes less in profit than the franchise takes in franchise fees.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but the question is, and this is something that the listeners are going to be thinking, is as an independent, can you compete against these so-called big names?
100%.
Yeah?
100%. And I think over time, not only will you compete, you should be able to destroy them, I'd say, over time. Like if you had a team of 6 salespeople that are all gold to platinum badge standard, you'd dominate the area.
Yes.
So, yes, 100%.
So the quality of your team and the quality of the people who work in the agency are more important than the name over the door.
It's all about the people. And I remember when we first opened up, like the first 12 months was pretty hard going, and you really had to control your mindset because it was very easy to let outside influences in. And I remember I never once looked on the internet to see what my competitors were doing, to see what the franchises were doing. I just completely ignored that noise. Mm. All I focused on was, where's my next listing coming from? Once I've got it listed, where do I get that reduced to a saleable price, and when is that going to settle? And then over time, if you keep that focus and the salespeople around you that come on board, you keep them focused on that as well. That's how they, in turn, can come into like a smaller agency as such, and that also builds belief in them that they can compete against the others.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. I wrote an article called Why Be in a Franchise, and what I said was, does anybody really believe that people list with a company because of the name over the door? You know, if a company has high quality salespeople, as you mentioned, and those people are out doing the right things by clients, getting the highest possible prices, is it because of the name over the door? Is it because of the quality of the sales team?
I mean,
it's just ludicrous thinking to think that a big name is going to protect mediocrity.
And
if you're not mediocre, then why not use your own name? That's what we've always said. So you don't have any trouble competing against the big names, but let's talk about the software that you chose, because an officer's capacity to market is very important, and so certainly we can distribute leaflets, but we know that when we write letters, they're more likely to be read if they're personally addressed with a personal greeting. So, dear Mr. and Mrs. Smith, or dear Mr. and Ms. Smith, or dear John and Betty, as opposed to the generic kind of letter with dear neighbour or dear homeowner. So,
yes.
So how important is a good CRM, a good database, full, and how important is a high quantity of high quality data?
Yeah, it's 100%, mate. I remember having a weekend receptionist at the time, and she would collate that data so we can address STLs to dear Mr. and Mrs. Pittard, for example. And we made sure that was in place very early on.
So these are STLs, are specific target letters?
That's correct, yes. Also, when you talk about like quality data, we also made sure that, you know, the inquiry log system was getting collected properly, the to let the owners were collected, the garage sales were collected, and over time, you know, when you first start building it, it doesn't look like much, but 5 years down the track, you can look at it thinking, okay, I can have a salesperson come in here now, and they've got a whole bookshelf full of sources that they can rip into. So
yeah,
critical,
sources for finding listings. Yep. And in Queensland, you're not allowed to, if you buy a database where the data was sourced directly or indirectly from a government department and you send a letter to the clients in that database, you can be heavily fined, can't you?
Yes.
But there is no law that says you can build your own database by finding out who lives where and entering, getting permission to contact them and then marketing to them through your database.
Absolutely.
So it's a major source of branding for Johnson Real Estate Forest Lake?
Yeah, and I think the people are the branding itself. Like when you talk about marketing, like they're the guys that are out there speaking to 103 people on the field, pounding the pavement. So having the right people on board, knocking on doors, handing out cards, getting contacts, I think that's a big part of the branding as well.
Mm. And did you do any other kind of marketing to brand your company in those early days?
Not in the early days, mate, no.
Okay, but you kept it pretty solidly with your specific target letters, out knocking on doors. You were aggressively marketing as much as you could within your budgetary restraints at the time?
Absolutely, yes.
Uh-huh. Now, you stayed in the hole in the wall for 6 months or so, is that right?
Yes.
And then how long was it before you expanded into larger premises?
I think it was about 2 years, Gary. At that stage there, we had a couple of salespeople, so we stayed on for a year lease at the first place, then we signed up for another one and we moved from that premises to the premises that we're at the moment because we needed more space.
Yeah.
So our office now consists of the potential for 5 full-time salespeople plus a home finder as well. That's the space that we want to create, and then if we outgrow that, then we'll have to get something a little bit bigger, probably in about 2 to 3 years.
Uh-huh. So sequential growth rather than trying to start big at the beginning.
Yeah, very much so. So still, even though we're a little bit more established now, we're always still thinking about how do we keep the overheads as low as we can.
Did you, when you consider that you're in a little hole in the wall with a plastic with plastic table and chairs, did that make it more difficult for you to hire salespeople?
I think it did. In hindsight, I certainly think it did. But I think if you've got the right mindset, and when you are hiring, just the way you verbalise things and maybe selling them on the vision as well is also important, because they end up buying you, I think, as opposed to the company.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But, you know, too, some people will find it exciting to be part of a startup.
Yes.
You see, there seems to be an awful lot of competition for salespeople in the real estate industry, but typical real estate agents are busy trying to poach their competitors' salespeople. But you never went there, did you? You hired inexperienced people and taught them how to sell.
Very much the program, Gaz. Like, I'm very big on following the program as closely as I can. I have seen other people where they sort of, okay, I'll do a little bit over here and a little bit over there. But I remember, because early in my career when I stepped into that leadership role, I leaned on Jono a lot for advice. He certainly influenced me a lot.
That's Michael Johnston. Michael Johnston works with Pittard, yep.
Absolutely, sorry. Okay. And he spoke a lot about FTFS, which is just follow the fantastic system, yeah. And follow it. Don't do a little bit of this and don't do a little bit of that. If you do this properly, the management program spoke about in 5 years' time, you will have a winning team. So I've always just believed that 100%. So we didn't dabble here. We just, okay, the system says that, I'll go do that.
Well, you see, in the absence of a system, you have no system. And so what you're constantly trying to do is reinvent the wheel every time there's a drama. So by having a hiring system, you were far in a better position to be able to identify potential winners and take and be able to decide on which person you would take a punt and put them on.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it hard? You see, when you're a selling principal, you're out listing and selling and paying the bills. Is it hard to hire a salesperson while you're still trying to list and sell? I mean, you're juggling a lot of balls, aren't you?
Yeah, and that's probably been the most difficult part of it, I think, being able to manage salespeople while listing and selling yourself, because in essence, what you're listing and selling is actually keeping the business afloat cash-wise as the team grows, because your expenses grow. But getting them productive as quick as you can as well, that way they start paying their way, and then you can start seeing the profit. So by far one of the most difficult things, having the ability to change from, okay, I'm a salesperson, hey, I'm a manager now, or I'm a leader, having the ability to switch hats quickly is really important.
Still keep your focus on the sales, but not take your focus off the recruit that you're trying to develop into a winning salesperson.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because your level of service to the client as a salesperson actually drops off. So I notice as a salesperson, I wouldn't pamper my vendors as much, because my vendors essentially became my salespeople, because they were more important to me than a vendor. I know it sounds bad, but it's just the way it works.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you get your sales team right, they can help a lot more people, can't they?
Very much so. And we were all very big on, I had Keane that came on board with me, and he was probably one of my first winning salespeople. And we concentrated on getting him right. And then once he got bedded in, we started thinking, okay, how do we build a team around Keane? So then we started hiring, and because he set such a high bar and a great example, we'd say, look, Keane's done it. If you do this and you follow this system, you too can get the same results. And then you started building around him.
Would you say that first salesperson is the hardest one?
Yes, by far. By far. But if you get the right one, and the first one is the most important, because that's the team and the culture that you build around. So I remember early on, I had a lady that started with us, came in and just absolutely killed it. Like, she was getting results, and you can just see her being quite successful in real estate, but her culture was toxic. And I was lucky in the sense that I knew what I wanted from the team from a culture perspective. So I remember letting her go very, very quickly. And it's a hard thing to do when you're on your own, thinking, oh, you know, I can start being profitable now, as opposed to really just getting by, to let her go and make sure that I've got that right person in that right seat on the bus is just critical, or else you're never going to be able to build a winning team. You'll probably have a big team, but not a Michael Meakin team, and that's what we were sort of striving for.
Do you know, it's a sign of character when you're willing to dismiss somebody that may be writing the figures but who doesn't fit the culture. You know, as you say, it's a tough thing to do, especially when you're on your own. But you keep a toxic person, all you're ever going to bring on to the into the company are other toxic people. And what a horrible way to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. When you first opened, just to go back to the shoebox days, Pete, did you have much in the way of support staff?
The first 6 months, no, Gaz. So the first six months I did photos, I did my own signs, I did building a test, I absolutely did everything, which was really great, because now, as being the business owner as such and managing it, you know every intricate detail throughout the business, and I think it's an important thing.
Yeah.
But after the six-month period, then we started getting support, and, you know, a supporter in place, then a receptionist, and we started building from there.
Have you got to watch your balance of admin people to salespeople? I mean, if you are on your own and you have three admin people to support, it's a lot more sales that you personally have to make before you start to make a profit. So do you think that you have to watch that balance of support staff to sales, you know, let's call it production staff? Do you think you have to watch that balance?
Yeah, absolutely, mate. And I think the way we did it in the early stages really worked, because it kept our overheads down and it kept the pressure off.
Yeah.
Somewhat of the pressure off. But now that we've sort of, you know, myself, we're up and going, Adam's flying at the moment, and it just makes it easier now that we set up a new office. The structures are already in place, and we've already learned so many lessons of what not to do. The next person that comes on, we can just, okay, let's set you up. This is the area. Support staff is here, and they really hit the ground running, so it's really exciting.
Did you, back in those days too, you're on your own, so you can't be working, around the clock, because you're going to burn yourself out. So what were your trading hours as a one-person operation?
You traded all the time, Gaz. Early days, I think, and I tell people sometimes, you've got to be careful what you wish for. The idea of opening up a business and being a leader and having a sales team around you, the idea sounds all great, but what I've discovered is it actually gets, it's harder. And as you get more success, it actually gets harder. Then that you just can manage more. Early on, though, it's just all the time, Gaz.
Yeah.
I remember waking up at dawn, me and my seven-month-old pregnant wife were dropping STLs.
Yeah.
I'd get in the office at 7:30. I'd start prospecting. I'd door knock until sweat was just dripping off me. My wife would meet me at midday to change shirts. I'd just door knock. You just work and work and work.
Yeah.
And then you'd get home and follow the manual. You'd read the manual. You'd read the winning ways. You'd read the management program. You'd do your affirmations. You'd relook at your goals. And then you'd read and study, because you want to make sure that you're working on yourself as much as you're working on your business as well.
So what I'm reading into this is dedication.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I was certainly committed, and the business came first.
Yeah.
So we sat there and we thought, as a family, okay, the business has to come first. Everything else is superfluous after that.
And do you think that having a supportive spouse and making these decisions, I mean, you're not talking about doing it forever, are you? You're talking about just until you get the business off the ground and you start to get some people working in the company. So do you think that that's a productive conversation to have with your significant other?
Yeah, I'm pretty fortunate that I've got a partner that... I think people make the mistake of having a partner and thinking, okay, you've got to have a supportive partner. And what that looks like is she's, okay, get out there, conquer the world. But my partner's not like that. She just understands that I'm committed to what we want to build and we get there together. So she doesn't pull me back in some regards, but she doesn't stand there saying, hey, go out there and get it. She just lets me do my thing. And I think that is a supportive partner.
I agree.
Not a partner that's with the whip, or, hey, what time are you going to be home for dinner because I'm cooking a roast? I never have that.
They don't put that, by not putting that pressure on you. You know, she understands that you're building something for the family, and that's going to take a bit of work to get it off the ground. And that really is, that is terrific support.
Absolutely.
So what do you think you did right when you opened the agency, Pete?
I followed the system, Gaz.
Yeah.
I really did follow the system, like from the hiring, just everything. Getting people around me and letting my ego down and asking for advice all the time, I think that was really important, like talking to Jono a lot. I remember driving down the coast having coffee with Jono, or even now and then. I know Jono goes for his morning walks on certain days on the Esplanade at the Gold Coast. I'd meet up with him and we'd go for a walk and we'd just talk. I'd always be ringing Trimmy asking for advice.
Mm.
But I was very fortunate that Adam opened up at the same time. So we were like running partners. So we'd be on the phone to each other all the time. And he's a smart guy. And also Trimmy and Jeff and Chris as well. So I'd bounce off them all the time. It's, you know, that line in the manual, champions find a way to win.
Hmm.
I think that's what that means, is if you don't know it, ask. Let your guard down and just continually ask and be curious. Or else you'll just stay stagnant and you'll go backwards really quickly.
Yes. And this asking for advice, I mean, let me point out that Michael Johnston is not exactly down the road from you. He's on the Gold Coast, you're in Brisbane. So,
that's right.
So you had to make an effort to get down there for those morning walks. Likewise, talking with Andrew Trim and the other people in your leadership group with leaders of the other agencies, you know, you're all very, very busy. So you have to go out of your way to ask advice and to take advice, and so you were well and truly prepared to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I also remember being more addicted to reading, like just studying and bettering yourself. Like Jim Rohn talks about, you've got to work more on yourself than you do on your job. And I really took that to heart. So I thought, if you want to build a winning team, you've got to make sure that you're right first.
Yeah.
You look after yourself. And if you expect people to go out there and write affirmations and speak to 103 people every day and study, I think as a leader, you have to do twice as much.
Hmm.
That way that adds credibility, and the people think, oh, geez, Pete works all the time. He's asked me to read 10 pages of the manual every day. He's going home and reading 50. It just adds enormous credibility on yourself, and they're more likely to trust your advice as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. What do you wish you'd done better or differently?
Hired. We got complacent hiring. So we built up a team of 5 salespeople and a full-time home finder. So in essence, the office was full. Got a big successful. And I think complacency, we always knew that was going to be a danger, but it's just one of them things where it just creeps up on you and you don't even know it. You're aware of it, but suddenly, you know, one person's gone, the other one's gone, and suddenly you're back to a smaller team. And you just think, how did that happen? And you can always trace it back to the hiring program. So although we were still hiring, I think our intensity of the hiring dropped off as the team grew to a certain size. I suppose we got comfortable.
Do you think it's also a little easy to take the eye off the ball of the results ball and allow maybe, while you're so intent on building a larger team, that you might let the results of some of the people on the teams fall?
That's exactly what happened. I remember, and I can picture her right now, your standards drop. So I had 4 good salespeople performing well, and I had one that came through, and I just noticed that, you know, she'd be a little bit late here, and I would sort of let her get away with that. Or she would just make certain comments that normally I would not compromise on. I started to, because I started thinking, okay, let's get this team, you know, we're making a good profit. And it affects your team subconsciously on a massive level. And it was only until you let people like that go do you realise that how toxic they were.
Yeah, it's subtle sometimes too. It's sort of like when you see a friend's child and you hadn't seen the child for a while, you say, gee, how you've grown, but the parents don't really notice.
Absolutely.
Pete, let's just go back to where we're talking about competing against the big names. When you first opened an agency, did you find it hard to get sellers to trust a newly opened agency?
No, because they bought me.
Yeah?
And that's the thing. Like, we were speaking about the question you asked before about marketing and branding the company. Your system that our salespeople follow is designed to prospect, to get in front of people. Once you're in front of people, you follow the listing program, you will get the listing. So I found that once myself or my salespeople got their foot in the door, you can convert it. That was the challenge. Not so much the objection of you're a smaller company, they would buy you.
But did your competitors try to lay landmines and just say, oh, he's a one-man band, he's new? Did your competitors try and cause trouble for you that way?
Yeah, I think they certainly did, because we got a lot of complaints from council about our signs and putting it on the road and pinning it to fences and all sorts of things. And we did Operation Wipeouts, and we certainly got council complaining a fair bit to us about that. That would only come from our competitors. But we never really took our focus off the ball in the early stages. It was very much, let's build it, let's just ignore the rest. Because you can, what you focus on grows. And if we focus on them and what they're doing, you'll get influenced by that. All we had to focus on was, where's our next salesperson coming from? Where's our next sale coming from? And let's list it. If it hasn't sold, we need to reduce it. So just following the system and ignoring the noise out there.
You know, when you were hiring salespeople, is it easy, do you think, or tempting to fall into the trap of just remaining a one-man band, a one-person operation? I mean, you're used to listing and selling and bringing money in the door and keeping the doors open. Your expenses are low, so you're starting to make a bit of profit. Do you think that it's a pretty simple trap to fall into, to not hire, to not look for salespeople?
Yeah, absolutely. I can see how that can happen. But I just having the clear vision on what you want to achieve before opening makes that easier, because it's the intricacies of having a new salesperson coming on board and flicking them a listing. It's almost like you're throwing $6,000 away. That's how it feels. But if you've got that vision of, okay, look, this is where we want to go and where we want to be in the next 5 years, we want to follow the manual, because the manual says in 5 years' time you'll have a team of 5 to 6, and that will lead you towards freedom of choice. So that has always been my, how do I get to freedom of choice? That's just been an absolute burning desire that we need to get to.
So if you work on the agency on a daily, work in the agency on a daily basis, you do it because you want to, not because you have to.
Absolutely, yes.
Do you think that there's security in having a larger team? A security for you as the agency owner, and security for the business in total?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's why we're doing it. Like, you just wouldn't go through what you have to go through in order to build that, unless that's not the end goal. Or if you could just be a salesperson. What's the point? So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, you see, while you're working, selling as a principal, so you're listing and selling, you've got a job, haven't you, really? You don't have a business.
Yeah, it's exactly in the manual. You have a high-paying job,
not
a business, and we certainly want to build a business.
Peter, how do you get salespeople up and running and productive quickly?
Make sure that they're following the Winning Ways manual. So from start to finish, they're reading it, they've got their affirmations in place, they're doing their numbers, very much just following the system, Gaz. Yeah. The system works. Make sure that they monitor it. So Jono taught me this line very early on, inspect what you expect. So you continually, how you're traveling with that, you know, make sure that you're doing your one-on-ones on a weekly basis. Make sure that you're mentoring them and giving them the right time, not just running around trying to sell and keep the business afloat. You've got to be able to compartmentalize, okay, what can I do to keep the business afloat right now? How's that salesperson going? How are they following the manual? And make sure that they've got certain systems and procedures in place that they're following as well.
Are you also ensuring that they conduct ongoing, or that they have ongoing training?
Yeah, training's big with us. That's how we build our business. And I suppose the answer to your question there is, how do you get them productive quickly, is you invest time in training. Because the initial graph that Jono draws on the foundations day is, when a rookie starts, you've got a certain amount of skills. So how they make up for that with results is they put in the time. So if you can double their skill level, they'll spend the same amount of time doing the task, but they'll be twice as effective. So we made sure that, you know, we had the Wednesday sales meeting, we had Friday training, we had the one-on-ones in place. And I always tell the guys, look, if you need more training, or you need me to go door knocking with you, or whatever you need from me, I will be there 100%.
Do you check their iTrain logs? You know, the Pittard streaming portal, you've got a log that can tell you what your salespeople are studying. Do you check the log from time to time?
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Yes, like a hawk.
You couldn't do that with CDs, could you? I'm very proud of that little feature, actually.
No, iTrain's great, mate, and you can monitor it. And you don't. And the interesting thing about that is if you notice that they haven't been watching it for a while, you don't turn around and say, hey, you haven't been watching iTrain. You just subtly drop in, hey, when was the last time you jumped on iTrain to listen to that? And then you can monitor it behind the scenes because the right people get it done.
When you were selling Principal, you have to remember that part of your role, or a large part of your role, is once you put people on, is that you're a leader. You're their trainer. You're their coach.
Yes.
And if you don't take time to do that and you just keep selling, well, then they're going to fall by the wayside, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I always had this, I don't know if you'd call it like a philosophy, but when you start early on and you start hiring people, letting people go to this day, I find it incredibly difficult. And I remember early on, I said to myself, if I don't give them 100% of my effort and I don't give them the right tools and the right support and I sack them, that's on me, not on them. So what I made a decision very early on is everyone that comes on board with me, I will give them everything I've got. They will become my priority. And if they don't work out, I can turn around and make a decision to get rid of them very quickly because I've given them everything. That's on them, not me. And it's like a negative perspective of it, but to this day, I give the guys everything I possibly can, time, after hours, dawn, night time, I don't care, I'll get it sorted for them. But it makes it very easy to let them go if they're not right.
This brings us back to when you're selling and then you start putting salespeople on, it does take your focus off making sales and getting listings and making sales yourself. Your partner Andrew Trim said, it's pretty well a 20% drop in production
that you
have to expect as a leader once you put on a salesperson. And a lot of people don't really want to run that risk, do they? So they might put people on, but virtually it's here's your desk, here's your phone, good luck, you're on your own. And then they whinge when the person doesn't work out.
Yes.
Is it still hard to do?
Yeah, absolutely, mate. You just can. It is still hard, but as you learn and grow more, it just you deal with things differently. And the more the more I learn, the more I feel like the less I know. It's really bizarre, but it's exciting. It becomes more exciting because you can deal with more, because you're learning more. And I think the team grows with yourself growing. It's sort of like a byproduct of the other.
Have you noticed that as a leader you go through a transition? When you're a salesperson, you get that thrill of making the sale, that thrill of getting the signature. But as a leader, there's a certain thrill, isn't there, in seeing people developing and growing within their role, maybe building a great life for themselves and their family, using their real estate career in your agency as a vehicle to do it. Do you get any enjoyment from helping people grow?
I think that's why I do it, Gaz. I get that. For me, seeing people succeed with my influence is the most satisfying thing there possibly can be. And I think that's why I do it. And I continually, I just love, I had Keane that works with me. He's just gone and opened up Johnson Real Estate in Browns Plains, doing really, really well. And I thought, I had somewhat influence and had part of that. And I love that. I love that more than anything. And I think with new people coming in, I think they can sense that because my language, we've got an internal culture here is, whether you're here with us for a year or 10 years, you'll be a better person when you leave, not just professionally, but I'd like to influence them on a more personal level as well.
Yeah. But isn't that a nice approach to have? And certainly there has to come a time as a leader when you do get that far more enjoyment from helping put a person together than you do putting a sale together. Otherwise, you'll constantly be going back and making sales because that's where your love is.
Absolutely. And Trimmy spoke about that 20%. That's spot on because a salesperson would come on board to get them right, your production drops 20%. You get the second one on board, that will drop 40%. You get the next one on board, that will drop 60%. And eventually, you'll get to a point where you get 5 salespeople on board, and then you're literally not productive, so you're not listing and selling in the field, only by referrals or the odd one here and there. And I think at that point, that's when you're starting to build a team around you.
Yeah, a business.
A business,
Because let's face it, where does it stop? If you're going to keep making the sales yourself, well, why don't you do the cleaning and save money on a cleaner? Why don't you answer the phone and save money on a receptionist? Why don't you be a property manager too while you're at it? Think of all the money you could save. You'll die, but you know, but people don't seem to sometimes make that distinction. Well, hang on, I'm not going to always be a salesperson, and that's why I'm starting a business. Let's go back to the decline when as you started to build your team. I remember Andrew said that as your team grew, your team was growing, but you didn't notice the decline in performance at first. And you mentioned that there was a drop in standards and things like that. But were there any other warning signs that you missed at the time, Peter?
I don't know, Gaz. I think back to that and I think, I wonder what it was. And I know it's complacency. And I know complacency is a dangerous thing, but you don't see it. I think it's like being overweight sometimes. Like, you don't wake up the next day and you look down and think, oh, geez, I'm pretty fat. It's sort of, you know, you eat a little bit extra here and over there and you don't really notice until one day someone says, hey, you're probably a little bit overweight.
Yeah. And I think that's reasonable too. You know, some of those things can, you know, the drop in standards, you're not going to notice it immediately. It's like when you take shortcuts as a salesperson, you don't notice the effects immediately, but you certainly start to see it in your results a little further down the track. Now that you've got a team, let's talk about agency control. You know, what do you think of the essential elements of agency results control? You know, how do you keep the team focused on results? How do you keep yourself focused on results? How do you know when people are falling behind? I believe it's a real art form to tell when a salesperson's headed for a slump and stopping it before it happens rather than waiting until they get into a slump and then trying to correct it. So how do you control the results of the agency? What are the main tools?
I'm not going to sound parrot-like fashion, Gaz, but just following the system, like making sure that you are doing the sales meeting on time, you've got your action sheet, you're monitoring your action sheet, you're following that up, so inspect what you expect, enforcing standards, making sure that they're accountable. If they don't do the actions, what's the recourse for that? Uh-huh. You can't let people get away with certain aspects of your culture because the culture in an office is like a living, breathing thing. If you're not constantly monitoring it and checking it, it will just consume you. And so following the system.
And you don't pay commission only, so you actually have some control, don't you? You pay good salaries to salespeople. They have bonuses as well. And so because you're paying the salary, and it's in excess of the typical award salary, you've got a right to insist that certain actions are being done.
Yeah, absolutely. And because they see you doing the actions more so as well, then they just can't help not to do the action. I think they would naturally feel guilty. But just monitoring it, mate, the control board, constantly looking up at that, seeing, okay, I wonder how he's doing. I wonder how she's travelling. You know, her attitude's not quite right. Let's catch up for a one-on-one and see how she's going. What's wrong at home? Normally it's the home life. So just really, I think being aware of it and thinking about it all the time.
Yeah.
Because the systems are in place. Like if you're following the program, you've got certain aspects in place where you can look at that and think, okay, that's not quite right, and you pull that lever. That's not quite right, and then you pull that lever.
The thing is, if you're focused, I mean, we talk about the mirror principle where the team is a reflection of the leader. Focused leader, focused team. Unfocused leader, unfocused team. Lazy leader, lazy team.
Yes.
Pete, what do you think are the big pitfalls to avoid when opening an agency?
Expenses. So I would suggest hiring a fancy office would be the big thing. That would be a huge pitfall.
Yep.
Not focusing on getting you right.
Yeah.
I think because if your headspace is not there, then you're just not going to make it. Or even if you do, you're really going to stumble along and build a pretty mediocre team, and then it's going to become too hard. So I would say that.
In hindsight, do you think you would have been better off buying an existing agency, or are you happy that you started from scratch?
Starting from scratch is the best thing we've ever done.
Yeah.
It's the road less travelled, and there's so many little lessons in it. Like an example, I would know now if someone's doing their numbers or not, if they're out there door knocking or not. I would know if a walker's not dropping letters or not, because I've done it all. So building from scratch, it's longer and it's more difficult, but the long-term effects of it, it builds a stronger foundation.
Now, another temptation that a lot of people have is to buy a rent roll, and often they buy rent rolls with borrowed money, which we don't believe is a very profitable exercise. But do you think it's wise to open with a rent roll?
mate, we built a house from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So, happy with that. There's obviously you don't have to borrow money to buy it. And just growing it intrinsically, I think, you end up with a better quality rent roll.
Yeah.
Like, I look at our rent roll at the moment, and I see Tracy, which runs that department, that's part owner as well. You very rarely get complaints from people, and I think that's very rare, because I had been in an agency where we were constantly getting complaints.
Yeah. So it wasn't a necessity when you first opened?
Absolutely not. No.
So do you think an office can be profitable without a rent roll?
100%.
Now, let's talk about one-stop shops. What are your thoughts on those? You know, you see some offices that are into everything. You know, they've got a little mortgage broking arm, they've got sales, they've got strata. They're in the country, they've got stock and station as well. They've got rental department. They've got so many different things happening. What's your thoughts on that?
I think that you'd have to have a team or like an individual that would look after each individual department, but being the sole trader doing that, it'd just be damn near impossible to do that. We found the last 5 years to 6 years on how we've been trading is I'm lucky in the sense that I can focus on the business, growing the salespeople around me, but then the other aspects like the rental side, that's shifted off to certain different departments that are organised differently. So if you've got the right people in place, I suppose, but individually, what you focus on grows and your focus will just spread too thin.
Yeah. Yeah, so what you did was focus on sales. You opened as a sales operation. Then as you got the people, then you looked at rentals after that.
Yes, absolutely. And the rentals just grow as the team grows.
Yeah.
Because they're out there prospecting and naturally that will just grow intrinsically.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for focus, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Peter, what are the major elements you think that contributed to your success? I know you've mentioned a few, but I'll just get you to encapsulate those.
I think educating myself
and
surrounding yourself with good people. So reading became and is now a huge part of my life. I think people that say they can't read or they don't get much from it, I think that's a bit of a cop-out. I never was a reader, but I forced myself to become a reader. Audio, listening to audio in the car, speaking to the right people, associating yourself with the right people, and just following the system. Okay.
Has the experience been rewarding?
Absolutely, mate.
Do you think business exacts a price that goes beyond money?
Yes, absolutely. And I go back to that comment, and I learnt this off Trimmy, is a lot of people set goals without thinking of the commitment needed to get there. Like for us to get where we are at the moment, we nearly lost our marriage. You know, that's how hard we were going.
Yeah.
So, yes, mate, it's, yes.
And I think you've got to be, do you think really you've got to be aware of that before you make the decision to open?
Yeah, I think so, or else it'll turn pear-shaped.
At least if you're aware of it, you can put it on the table, discuss it with your partner. And do you think that there's a necessity, though, sometimes just to knock off early and go and spend time with your family and just, you know, just even in the middle of as busy as you are trying to get everything up and running, there is only one of you and you've only got the one family. Do you think it's every now and then you just have to make yourself stop and say, right, tonight we're going to the movies?
If you put it in that perspective, recovery has always been an important part of the growth stage as well. So although we were going hard and we were working and just absolutely almost obsessed about it in the early stages, we made sure that we also took regular breaks. So even running the business, I remember back in the first 12 months, I would still take regular breaks every 3 months like a salesperson would at the end of each quarter. And that just gave you the ability to go away, recharge and actually enjoy time with the family. And then when you're back at work, be at work.
Yeah. Is business something that lazy and unmotivated people should consider?
No, they should consider working at McDonald's.
Final question, my friend. If someone approached you asking for advice on how to start a profitable agency, what advice would you give them, Pete?
I would say follow the system 100%. So I would say go to an agency profit management system, spend the 5 days there and just implement that.
Don't it's four do days now.
4 days. Yeah, sorry, that's 4 days. But do what the manual says, and you can build a business. Don't dibble and dabble, because I think that's where you don't get the results that you wanted is because you haven't put certain systems in place. And I can look at my journey so far, or our journey with the group, is the closer we've stayed to the system, we've gotten to that point. So following the system.
In the absence of systems, you're almost doomed to reinvent the wheel, aren't you? You've got to design systems for every single facet of your business.
Yeah, Og Mandino said that in one of his early books. He said, you could take a lifetime to create your own system. Why not follow someone that's already done it before and just repeat that? Because if you repeat that, you're more likely to get similar results. And that's always sat with it in my mind.
It's great advice. Peter Tran, thank you so much for talking to us about how to open a profitable real estate agency. There's a lot of good lessons in there for anybody thinking of undertaking that adventure. And certainly this case study, you talking about what happened to you in real life, I think would be hugely useful to a lot of people. And I can't thank you enough, and I'm sure our listeners will think exactly the same. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Gav. Appreciate it.